Welcome to Countersign. In these podcasts, I discuss books, films, and other materials with their authors and creators. This is the second series of Countersign. You can catch up on series one wherever you get your podcasts or by visiting countersignisapodcast.com. You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We welcome your feedback. More details at countersignisapodcast.com. Anyone who has met and discussed anything with Gerry Simpson would know what an exciting interlocutor he is. So I feel incredibly fortunate to have discussed his forthcoming book, The Sentimental Life of International Law. The book makes a major intervention in international legal thinking for many reasons. And I want to start with sort of setting out the key objectives of the book. But really, what we need to get to is the extraordinary literariness and style that the book manifests. And in fact, it is that question of style that will, I think, be one of the lasting contributions and influences of this wonderful text. A common conception, and indeed misconception, of international law is that it can be relied on to create peace and order in the world, if only it can be used as a guide to determine when the international community or particular states intervene in various sites of conflict and violence. And at the outset, Gerry sets out how he was often asked in the course of the Iraq War about its legality and whether the intervention should be taking place. And indeed, we're familiar with the same question being posed in relation to the intervention in Libya and more recently about whether the international community and the United States and European powers in particular should intervene in Syria to prevent the violence that has been taking place there. How are international lawyers meant to respond to this question about the lawfulness or indeed wisdom of any kind of intervention? And the book is in many ways a response to that question, because as Gerry points out, the response to sublime violence, extreme forms of violence, is often bathetic. There's an element of bathos that is brought to bear on these extraordinary conflagrations. And it's worth noting that this podcast is going out on the 75th anniversary of the Nuremberg trials, which are commonly perceived to have set out the key elements of international criminal law that pertain to crimes against humanity. One of the controversial dimensions of the Nuremberg trials, and indeed the Tokyo trials at the end of the Second World War, or the trial of Eichmann in Jerusalem, is the question of precedent. What precedent would be brought to bear on these crimes, so-called crimes against humanity? And as Gerry very pertinently sets out, on the one hand, the violence and mass killing and genocide is characterized as unprecedented. So that's one of the ways in which the violence is described. And at the same time, there's this demand for a precedent, especially a legal precedent, to be brought to bear on how the perpetrators will be dealt with. The question we faced is whether these kinds of juridical, legalized, punitive responses actually address the problems that international criminal law confront? Are they adequate to set a society or a community on a course of recovery and reconciliation and so on? Now, instead of the approach of finding a precedent for the unprecedented atrocity, for example, Gerry suggests an approach of re-precedenting, which involves thinking about memorial practices that approach the trials that never took place, or focusing on the gathering of evidence and the transcript rather than the decision of the court itself. He refers to the Milosevic trial as an example, where famously Slobodan Milosevic, who had been accused of multiple crimes against humanity, ultimately escaped the decision of the court by virtue of the fact that he died before that verdict could be granted. But nonetheless, evidence was amassed and a transcript was created. So just in that gesture of placing the emphasis on the transcript rather than the decision, a different kind of approach to memorial practices is created. In a distinctly sentimental approach to international law, Gerry proposes gardening, a pastoral approach to international law, as one that we need to think about. And encountering this garden, this enclave, this sanctuary, is a question of style. It's a way of inhabiting spaces, institutions, and indeed the manner in which we inhabit our own writing. Refers to the ventriloquizing that takes place in so many fields of law and in other disciplines, where we lose ourselves in what are regarded as common and influential ways of talking about law. And instead of this, I think the autobiographical, the emotional, the sentimental approach that Gerry brings to bear on international law offers a great deal for us to think about in not only our approach to international criminal law, but in every other aspect of legal thinking. Welcome, Gerry. It's lovely to be talking to you about your forthcoming book, The Sentimental Life of International Law. And I thought it would be really helpful to begin by talking about the motivations for writing this book. What were the sorts of problems that you were encountering as a critical international lawyer? What is the overall approach that the book adopts?
Yeah, Stuart, thank you. It's delightful to be here on the podcast. The Sentimental Life of International Law grew out of a number of experiences I've been having as an international lawyer on panels or as someone from whom something was required or wanted or demanded on panels that featured people other than international lawyers. So I'd have experiences where I'd appear on a panel on the Iraq War, for example, in early 2003, and I'd argue against the war, I'd marshal legal arguments, and at the end of the panel, someone would stand up and say something like, you know, well, what are you suggesting as an alternative here? It's a very typical demand made of critical international lawyers. And I gave the sorts of answers you might expect from a critical international lawyer very often. In fact, in that case, I said I didn't think we should do anything. And of course, I didn't mean we should do nothing. I just meant that intervention is not the first thing we should think of. or we shouldn't imagine ourselves as never having intervened before in Iraq. But these answers seemed deeply unsatisfactory, and I kept having experiences like that. And at least one of the chapters, if not the whole book, is inspired by the thought that I should be offering a different sort of answer, you know, something perhaps more, I don't know, more reconstructive, perhaps, without being overtly normative. And, you know, one of the themes in the book is to think about the virtues of what I called indirection, the idea of answering questions and thinking reconstructively, but in an indirect way. And I've been very inspired. I mean, you asked me about the sorts of experiences that had inspired the writing of the book. I've been very inspired by a verse of Emily Dickinson's, which I came across as an undergraduate student years and years ago, which was about the truth and about the idea of telling all the truth, but tell it slant, success in circuit lies. And I guess if you'd asked me for a single moment of provocation, then that would be it from about, you know, however many years ago, 40 years ago. This idea of telling the truth, but telling it slant, of approaching the truth about international law, if I can put it in those terms, that seems very strong, but about approaching international law in an indirect way in order to capture somehow the truth's superb surprise, too bright for our infirm delight, as she puts it. So that was at least part of the idea of the book. And so I wanted to think about how to speak a different sort of international law. I wanted to think about how the governing idioms of the discipline somehow disabled us from thinking and speaking in a certain way, and how we could perhaps even catalog or document so-called advances in international law as somehow retreats. Moral, linguistic, ethical retreats as well. And then to think about how we might be re-enabled to think about international law. So I had in my mind, as you often do, a series of possible readers. And I mean, my readership, my imagined fantastic readership changes all the time. But I'm always writing to someone or to an imagined group of people. And at various points while writing this book, I had in mind my own daughters in a rather sort of sentimental way, if you like. And what I didn't want to produce was one more downbeat assessment or glum assessment of a world gone wrong. So, you know, I didn't really want to write about Donald Trump or Erdogan or Boris Johnson or Brexit or even the conventional failures of international law. I mean, I certainly didn't want to write about international law's lack of enforcement, for example, or the problems of sovereignty, or any of these rather tired old routines. I wanted to do something very different. I wanted not only to offer up a kind of literature of international law, or at least a literary approach to international law, but I wanted to write the book in a literary form. I mean, there are obviously dangers in that, and one danger is pretentiousness. Another danger is a kind of depoliticization. But I actually think this project is very, very political in all sorts of ways that we can get to. But yeah, to go back to the initial question, or to sort of circle back, I just been feeling increasingly uncomfortable in a whole number of different settings, and I tried to parlay that discomfort into something intellectually interesting and inspiring. So
you had in mind a kind of a readership that is not just sort of wallowing in the sort of bogeymen, as it were, of the Trumps and the Erdogans and the Bolsonaros, but something that is going to reach beyond that kind of context in which international law is functioning. But I think the other important point you are making is that people see the positivist manifestations of international law, the legal instruments and conventions that have been adopted. For example, the Rome Statute that set up the International Criminal Court as a significant advance of international law. And part of what you're doing is actually thinking about the limits of that kind of approach to thinking international law. Is that right?
Yeah. I've been part of a group of people who have asked us just to hesitate a little bit on the brink, as it were, while we think about international criminal law. So this is a project, the idea of convening or holding war crimes trials for those who violate fundamental norms of international law, along the lines of these celebrated moments at Nuremberg and Tokyo in the mid-century. I've been part of a group of people who've asked us to think about the losses as well as the gains inherent in a project like that. And I mean, there are many possible losses. And one that I'm particularly concerned about is again a loss in the languages that we might use when we approach the problem of grave injury, mass atrocity, however we want to describe it. And maybe it's the case that jurisprudential languages are, if not inadequate, sometimes positively deforming or disabling in some way. I use the example of the First World War and the way in which we remember opposition to the First World War, the Great War, as a combination of the poetic, Siegfried Sassoon, Wilfred Owen, and so on, the idea of conscientious objection, or the notion of working class universalism. Those were three modes in which opposition to the Great War organized itself. We have, in a way, or it might be the case, that we've replaced all this with a reflexive punitive legalism, which has sort of taken over the field, as it were, absorbed all these other linguistic identities we might have had, all these other approaches we might have had to war. So we're left with, I say this in the book, we've moved from Sassoon's, you know, anguished gestures of the dead to serious violations of the laws of war. There's a sort of dropping off, a bathos, as I describe it in another of the chapters, in that move from the kind of poetic language of the early 20th century to a legalistic, somehow cold, sometimes arid language of the later 20th, early 21st century. So that's one of the things I've argued against.
Absolutely. And I think there's a really powerful part of the book when you point to these great trials of the great criminals, in quotation marks, which is part of the legalistic and punitive response to extreme violence. And you ask several questions in that context. One is that we focus on these trials, but we don't pay enough attention to the trials that never took place. And that's so in a sense, you're trying to almost do a kind of an archaeology of the monuments that were never built.
Yeah,
I can put it like that. And you're doing this not in a, you know, in a way that's dismissive of the responses that we've seen, but actually pointing out how in their own time, Nuremberg or Tokyo or the Eichmann trial, just as some of the examples you referred to, that there were debates taking place around the time of these events that saw the response of the trial as inadequate to the task.
Yeah, exactly. Just at a very basic level, in recent work, I've tried to recover, if not rehabilitate, some of those voices around 1918, 1919, and 1943, 44, 45, 46, which were resistant to the idea of war crimes trials. And I've tried to think back to that dissident tradition and to give it a voice in this work, because apart from anything else, in the last 15 to 20 years, critical international law has become, you know, an important part of the field of international criminal law. I mean, one might even say it's the dominant part, and in the sense, in the weak sense at least, that virtually everyone who writes about international criminal law is a critic, often in a weakly reformist way rather than a truly critical way. But you know, critical international law has become a very important aspect or idea in the field. And I mean, sometimes it's called anti-impunity. You know, if international criminal law is about anti-impunity, there's a group of authors who've described their approach as anti-impunity. I suppose to get away from the idea that they might be in favor of impunity, though, frankly, it would have been quite intellectually honest to say, look, I favor impunity in certain cases. It's not a fashionable idea, but it's an idea that deserves, you know, deserves some emphasis. So I tried to go back, or I have gone back to these two moments, you know, at the end of the two great European wars of the 20th century, where there were individuals who took a dissenting line when it wasn't at all popular. So people like Bishop Bell of Chichester, who made the point, and I think this is a compelling point. Indeed, it's a point that somebody like David Kennedy has developed much later on. Bell made the point that there was a relationship, an intimacy, if you like, between those who were in favor of war crimes trials and those who were in favor of the carpet bombing of Germany. So Bell thought of himself as being anti-bombing and anti-trials. And I found that immensely provocative. I thought, you know, what's going on here? It seemed to me to be an early example of that relationship between sort of muscular violence and liberal legal intervention and international criminal law. The way these all sort of combine into a kind of militarized humanitarianism or a humanitarianized military. And of course, we're very familiar with that in the contemporary era, but it was there in the early in the mid 20th century with Bell, who was, you know, was very, very generous both to German prisoners of war during the war, and was also very concerned about the reports coming in about Nazi Germany's treatment of the Jews. So he was early on a lot of things, and he was also ahead of his time on the question of international criminal law and its possible failings. And there are other characters, maybe slightly less savory, like Maurice Hankey, who was a prominent British politician, both in the interwar period and in the post-Second World War period, who calls, for example, for a day of oblivion rather than a day of remembrance. You know, it was time to forget everything that had happened, at least in relation to, you know, ordinary war crimes, if you like, and that maybe the thing that ought to be done after the war was to, you know, reconstruct countries or do other things other than hold trials. And this has a long history in international law. I mean, international law's history is a history of impunity, not anti-impunity. The idea of holding trials is a very new thing and a very controversial thing that somehow become entirely normalized. And it's become normalized at a rather peculiar moment, at the very moment when people who studied national law, criminologists and so on, and this was true when I went to university, were beginning to cast doubt on carceral law, beginning to cast doubt on the idea that we should be sending people to jail in very, very large and increasingly large numbers, and we're turning towards what was called, you know, and still is called restorative justice. At the very moment when we were turning away from punishment at the local level, we turned towards it at the international level, and liberals, you might have thought, would be rather cautious about retributive legalism, given the experience, say, in the United States during the Clinton and Bush eras, this massive expansion of jails and privatization and so on. Those same individuals were very enthusiastic about putting people in jail, indeed hanging them in the mid-20th century, using international criminal law. So I wanted to explore at least that paradox.
Yeah, I mean, what's particularly interesting, I think, about that period you're looking at in the mid-century is, and with reference to Maurice Hankey's book, which I find the title itself intriguing. I've not read the book, but maybe you could say a little bit more about it. Politics, Trials, and Errors. And what I mean, I'm quite interested in this notion that we should focus on error and failure, and that you can see a kind of whether that is a war or extreme violence, as having a particular history that becomes, we sort of glide over that history if we don't pay attention to the conditions under which it occurred, but also the conditions that you set for the future depending on how you approach the end of the war, as it were. So this question of the necessity of error, if you like, for human progress, if I can use that phrase with caution, but in a context where setting up punitive measures is seen as progress. I mean, that's the sort of expectation. I think that's the sort of conventional expectation that you respond with a prosecution, with a trial, and that serves to sort of monumentalize the moment of the end of the conflict. And the suggestion of thinkers and poets and writers that you engage with is that there is another way. The sort of sense that people have is that you need to have the trial and the theater of that moment. And that if you don't have that event of the trial, then you don't put the horrid past behind you and inaugurate a future. So I think you're coming at that in a very different way.
It's true that along with a number of other people in the field, I am interested in what is often described as failure. The failed projects of the past seem to me to have quite often utopian or aspirational or radically reconstructive dimension that gets lost if we simply describe them as failures and move on from them or leave them behind or fail to mention them at all. So I think that's been a general problem with the discipline, but with international criminal law, it's even more complicated, because at each point of inauguration, there is a failure to do something else, or a failure to remember that in convening a trial here, we've failed to convene a trial somewhere else. Yes. This may seem like a rather obvious point. So that, for example, at the beginning of the 20th century, there was a lot of talk about trying the Kaiser, but no talk at all about trying the Kaiser for example, the activities of the German state or German military in Southwest Africa, or indeed there was no reference to Belgian colonialism in the Congo at the beginning of the 20th century. And Belgium and Germany were major figures, as it were, in the construction of international criminal law. So Belgium was the first sort of international legal victim, as it were. Little Belgium had been attacked by the Germans, and all sorts of horrors had been perpetrated by the Germans, allegedly, in Belgium. Many of them turned out not to have taken place at all. And Germany was cast as the first villain in international criminal law, but not for what it had done in Southwest Africa, but for what it had not done, in a way, in Belgium. So this struck me as interesting. There were sort of double invisibilities happening here. For a start, the Germans were not being held accountable for anything that happened in the sort of prehistory of the Great War, and secondly, they were being held accountable for things they probably hadn't done during the Great War. But if you read the description of German atrocities in the First World War, even more fascinatingly, they look a lot like descriptions of atrocities that had happened in the Second World War. So what was described and misremembered in the First World War became something that was rendered invisible for the early parts of the Second World War. There are multiple historical ironies, in other words, in existence here. So I wanted to somehow retrieve the idea of those trials that had not taken place. And I think this is very important because international criminal law, like international law in general, is a little bit addicted to novelty. And in the case of war crimes trials, the particular addiction is an addiction to the idea of unprecedentedness. You know, we hear this word,
yes,
unprecedented, all the time. And in fact, if we look for the sort of ethical origins of war crimes trials, they're found in two places. One, the idea of unprecedentedness, the idea that these events, these crimes have never before been seen in history and have to be dealt with. And
so
secondly,
this is the sense that there is no precedent. Yeah. So I think that and that creates a sort of legal issue in its own sense, because if you say something is so utterly unique, it's never happened before, then what sort of legal paradigm do you bring to bear on it becomes the issue.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So exactly. So the origins of international criminal law, the source of legitimacy for the field, is lies in unprecedentedness, the very thing that a legal order can't somehow confront or cope with. So there's this strange relationship between the unprecedentedness on one hand, the origins of the field lying in that, and the requirement to find precedents that inevitably end up looking a bit inadequate, producing a form of bathos. So I discuss this in relation to the relationship between the sublime and the pathetic in one of the chapters on unprecedentedness. But the other idea, as I was saying, is the idea of conscience, in particular the conscience of humankind, that somehow also lies at the heart of this field. So in 1945 and in 1918-1919, the great powers referred constantly to this idea that there was a conscience of mankind, a juridical conscience of mankind, if you like, as they described it, that required us to hold trials, even in the absence of precedents, as it were. So that this conscience or consciousness, almost a natural law idea, continues to haunt the field, even while the field has tried to eradicate it. It is one of these sort of hidden supplements. So there's a dialectical process here between the need for legalization and the reliance on some extra legal category of conscience. And to go back to something I said about the Great War and the languages we use in the Great War, the language used in the Great War to describe or think about or think through resistance was the language of conscientious objection, a sort of privatized language of resistance, if you like, to a certain extent. And it was displaced by this idea, I think this much more authoritarian idea of a collective conscience that demands certain things from an embryonic legal regime. So that's something I explore quite a bit in, as I say, one of the chapters of the book.
And I think in the context of that discussion, I particularly like the way in which you move from this problem of the unprecedented to re-precedenting, which is to say, how do you envision a set of practices and an approach. So it is not a set of norms, it's not a set of laws, but a set of practices to memorialize what has taken place in a way that doesn't create these edifices of punitive, so-called punitive justice.
That's right. So I was, again, just to go back to the prompts for this book or for the different parts of the book, I was very taken for a while by the anti-monumental artists of the post-war era in Germany. The way in which, when they were asked to construct or build monuments to the experience of say, German Jews in the Holocaust, they refused monumentalism. So they felt that they couldn't build a series of phallic objects in the 19th century style to memorialize an event like the Holocaust. Something else had to be done, something in a more modernist vein, if you like, something that resembled less perhaps the very forms of modernity that had brought us to this point in the first place. So it seems inconceivable to them just to stick up a large monument in Hamburg or Bremen to the destruction of the Jewish population in those cities or towns. So they engaged in acts of dememorialization or unmemorialization or anti-monumentalism. And I was very taken by this. And I'll speak about an example in Britain, in fact, in Trafalgar Square in a second. But some of these German monuments involve, for example, large rectangular objects that would sink slowly into the ground before disappearing in one case. This was a monument to German Jewish children in one town. And that struck me as very provocative. The idea of, sort of rendering invisible the monument and in that way perhaps bringing to visibility certain acts, moments that had been rendered invisible by monumentalism itself. So that seemed like a provocative way to go about thinking about international criminal law. And I always begin my classes in this subject by asking students to visit the memorial for Edith Cavell, a British nurse, which sits just outside the National Portrait Gallery in London, just north of Trafalgar Square. Edith Cavell's execution by the Germans in 1915 really set this whole business in train. Lloyd George was so outraged by this, or at least said he was outraged by it, proclaimed that he would hold war crimes trials for the Germans and for the Kaiser, who he held directly responsible for the execution of Edith Cavell. This is a big thing.
So it's worth saying a little bit more about her and that she was a nurse during the First World War.
She was the last person you'd want to execute if you were the Germans in the First World War. She was She was a British nurse, or a British lady, as she's described in newspaper reports around that time. English lady, even better. So she was an English nurse who had been working in Brussels and became involved in a system or a scheme to remove Allied prisoners, POWs in a way, from Belgian hospitals and send them back across the lines to the United Kingdom. And this was remarkably quite successful. She was very instrumental in this. I mean, she may have even been a spy, according to recent reports, but the Germans discovered this system and put her and her accomplices on trial and executed two or three of them, one of them being Edith Cavell. Cavell's monument stands outside Trafalgar Square, and it's a classic monument in the monumental tradition in one sense. For example, if you approach it from the south of Trafalgar Square, the first word you see in bold on the monument in Carrara stone is the word humanity. And one of the arguments I've made throughout my work is that this moment was the moment when juridical humanity was inaugurated or baptized in some way, and that we still live in this moment where we think of ourselves as part of a juridical humanity. So crimes against humanity, for example, or the idea of the international community acting here, there, and everywhere, very much an inheritance of that moment. But when Edith Cavell's family was asked by the committee established to memorialize Cavell what they would prefer, they said, "Well, we don't want a monument.
No monuments, please.
Away with monuments in the Nietzschean style. Away with monuments. We don't want monuments. We don't want monumentalism. We'd like you to build a nursing home for nurses." It's a poignant idea, and even more poignant in these COVID days. But that was completely disregarded by the committee, and instead we have the monument instead. to me, that's a good example, or at least a metaphor, for the sort of work I've been trying to do in the international criminal law field. At a very basic level, this began with a project I engaged in a few years ago with Kevin Heller to tell the to describe the hidden history of war crimes trials in a project we call Untold
But just
Stories.
Before Gary, just before we move on from Cavell, I think it's worth adding the subtext that was placed on the monument, which is, I believe, a statement from her. Quote, "I realize that patriotism is not enough." That was added later to the monument.
Yeah, they refused to have her words included in the monument at first, and then these words of hers were added. So she wasn't a particularly monumental figure herself. She was one of these people that had been co-opted by the British state to remember something else entirely. And she sits among all the various imperial masters in Trafalgar Square. But there's a moment in Virginia Woolf's The Years when two characters pass the monument, and one of them says, "Yes, look at that. It's the only decent thing that was said during the war." But that was deliberately obscured, if you like, rendered invisible when the monument was being constructed in the name of monumentalism. So many of Cavell's own wishes and the wishes of her own family were rendered obscure in this moment of monumentalism. And I suspect, or the point I'm trying to make, I suppose, is that when we construct the great edifices or monuments of international war crimes law, we're also in that process rendering invisible so much, and that any creative engagement with international criminal law should engage with those losses. So Stuart, I'll just give you one sort of more concrete example of this from the Nuremberg war crimes trials. I mean, Nuremberg is usually understood as a moment of memorialization. After all, it memorializes the Holocaust, or it memorializes something else. But in some ways, it's also an act of forgetting. It's a kind of juridical amnesia, if you like. So one example of that would be that prior to the war, it was generally understood that the bombing of undefended cities was unlawful, perhaps even a crime under international law. This is something that we see in the Hague rules and Hague conventions from the early 20th century, late 19th century, 1899 and 1907. And in fact, Austen Chamberlain stood up in the Houses of Parliament and said, well, you know, obviously in 1938, obviously bombing cities from the air, bombing civilians from the air is illegal. Well, we might say that Nuremberg and Tokyo, the two great mid-century trials that are often said to have been the origins of international criminal law, were moments when bombing was somehow declared lawful because bombing wasn't prosecuted. The bombing by the Allies, obviously, the you know, fairly gratuitous bombing of German Baltic cities in 1945, those great timber cities on the northern coast of Germany were turned to ash by Bomber Command in 1945 for no real strategic benefits, if indeed there can be strategic benefits from such bombing, even theoretically. So that was all forgotten at Nuremberg, but also forgotten was the German bombing of London and Wolverhampton and Coventry and so on. So it's a moment of it's a moment of forgetting. It's a moment of amnesia. It's a deliberate consigning to invisibility of some really critical dimension of war making in that period. So war crimes trials have what you might think of as perverse consequences that go very often unnoticed in the celebration of all this monumentalism.
Are you there, Gary? I think you just cut out again.
I'm still there. No. I just stopped, actually.
Oh, okay. No, I see.
Yeah.
Very good. Really, really, really important to be talking about Nuremberg right now. It's also the 75th anniversary this year, I believe, of the Nuremberg trial. And I think this, kind of useful point to move to the pastoral approach that you very beautifully illustrate in the book. So you talk about gardening in a number of different ways, I think in a really rich and evocative ways. And so perhaps you could begin to tell us a little bit more about this pastoral approach or gardening as an approach to international law. And I think it would be useful to sort of set that in the context of this being a project that is distinctly of the humanities. So you're also saying, well, this approach to international law is an assertion of what the humanities has to offer.
Yeah, it's undoubtedly located in that tradition. And one might even say it's an example of a very chastened humanism. It has also been described by various interlocutors as a sentimental project. I'm not really entirely sure what the word sentimental means here, but I suspect maybe a little bit lachrymose, maybe a little bit somehow indulgent, but I'm deadly serious about this business. Mm-hmm. And it grew out of, again, to go back to something that emerged earlier on in this conversation, it grew out of a sense that I was constantly being asked questions that I either didn't want to answer or didn't have an answer to. And I've struggled with the idea of the answer. You know, how does an international lawyer committed to some form of critique, committed to an endless historicization, committed to complexity, committed to hesitancy, how do you answer questions in seminars? And I've tried all sorts of techniques. I tried, you know, not answering. But as I say in the chapter, that gives the impression that you don't know the answer. And we still, even in these anti-expert times, we still cling on to the idea that we have some expertise at least. So that didn't work. And I'd be accused sometimes if I gave very long, elaborate, fully historicized answers that I was either taking too long to answer, not coming to the point, or over intellectualizing. So there was a risk here, and as I say, it came up in an encounter I'd had while talking about the Iraq War. I tried, in fact, in one lecture I gave in Melbourne on the Iraq War, I tried to adopt a slightly different tack and talk, you know, like, as it were, a traditional international lawyer might talk about the Iraq War, you know, thinking about self-defense and Article 2.4 and so on and so forth. And I was approached by a former Australian Prime Minister after the talk, and he said to me, "I just wanted to say that I found your talk very, very relevant." And a little part of me died in that moment. I decided I didn't want relevance either. And in fact, the whole book is an argument against relevance and against it's an anti-instrumental account of the humanities. It wants people not to ask what's the point of this, but how do I experience this? I would like the book, if this doesn't sound too grandiose, to be experienced rather than for people to parse it for answers to specific questions. Certainly technical questions on investment law, the law of the sea, don't come to my book for that, obviously, but also even answers to questions about what is to be done. I you know, the sort of Leninist question I've tended to avoid. But ultimately I thought, well, maybe I do have to offer a more upbeat account of what could be done, what might be done instead, or what might be done differently, or how we might speak differently. So the book talks a lot about how we might talk about international law in a different way, in a different mode.
And here I think that, Gary, sorry to interrupt, but I think the thing that you're sort of hitting on now is this notion of the exterior glance, and I thought that was a really evocative notion that I think you draw from Jay Winter, who draws it from Paul Ricoeur. And I think that that sense in which, you know, you don't want, this is not a book to come to take away a program or an agenda. It is much more about the experience of the problem itself and how to approach that, you know, in what in what manner to approach the thinking of a problem. So I wanted to just point out that important notion of the exterior glance.
Yeah, it's very hard to adopt an exterior glance these days. It's hard to get outside a language. It's hard to get outside a system. It seems to be something about late capitalism that makes it very, well, we know partly why, that makes it very, very difficult to step outside the system without immediately being cast as a utopian crank. In other words, there's not much room for anything beyond cranky utopianism and general passivity. Anything. I mean, we saw that with the progress of Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, Corbyn, and I don't want to talk about Jeremy Corbyn for too long, but Corbyn had a fairly modest set of redistributive ideas about British society and economics, and yet was cast precisely in these terms as a crazy utopian crank who had to be replaced as soon as possible. It's a miracle he survived for so long. So I've been trying to find some sort of space for what we might think of as chastened utopianism, or what Jay Winter calls minor utopianism. And this is very much inspired by someone like Fred Jameson, who talks about anti-utopianism. So it may be difficult, as he puts it, to be full-bloodedly utopian these days after the horrors of the 20th century. I think that point needs to be debated even so. But nevertheless, let's accept it for these purposes. It may be difficult to be utopian, but that doesn't mean we should be anti-utopian. Anti-utopian is the position of those who accept the existing allocation or distribution of life chances in society. So maybe one way to think through these things is to be anti-utopian, to somehow recover some ground through these, what Jameson calls enclaves, where we can think through, think about the future in new languages, as I try to do in one of my international law classes, which I think of as an enclave, again, in a somewhat pretentious manner. So I came to a gardening precisely as an enclave in this way, and thought about the way people had responded to international law through gardening or through the pastoral. And so I spent a lot of time talking in this chapter about utopianism and utopian experimentation in international law generally, Philip Allott et al. And then I talk about some of the problems with gardening. So it's not as if I'm all over the pastoral. It's not as if I don't have some hesitancies around that as well. Zygmunt Bauman has talked about how gardening is often about removing weeds. It's a sort of authoritarian project of its own, and we know that there was a connection between Nazism and horticulture that has been documented by several writers. And gardens are associated with suburbanism, picket fences. In Australia, where I used to live, it was very strongly associated with conservative governments, John Howard's picket fences, and so on. So I was
and also I think that the other reference I wanted to bring to bear here on the sort of negative side, as it were, on gardening, is the way in which in the Mabo case, the Miriam people had their native title or their relationship to the land finally recognized very much on the basis that, unlike other nomadic peoples, that they were gardeners. And in a sense, they conformed to a sort of Lockean idea of property that involved mine and thine, that they had a sense, they had a system of law that allocated ownership to different parts of the community. So there is this sort of double edge to gardening and notions of cultivation and so forth, but I think you're obviously trying to navigate a path through that.
Yeah, it's interesting that you should mention the Mabo case. The book, this book is a personal, somewhat autobiographical approach to international law. I mean, there's quite a bit of storytelling in it. And when I discuss writing, for example, because any you know, literary account of international law has to account for writing, you know, how we write about the field. And I've always been struck about how similar much of the writing in international law is. There's a small number of people who write in a distinctive way, but many people write in the what I've called the ventriloquized voice of the discipline, so that when you read essays, it's very unusual to identify the writer. If you're a referee, for example, on a law review, or you're an editor of a law review, it's quite rare. But there are certain individuals in the field who I could identify immediately. They're a minority, 3 or 4%. And I wondered, you know, why this was, how people who managed to adopt a distinctive style did it, and why everyone else didn't do it, and what the effects on the discipline, on the health of the discipline were, that so many people wrote in this rather anonymous voice of the field, sort of respectable international lawyer. And I talked about my own history as a writer. I went through a sort of middle period. I always think that the 40s are a tricky period anyway, but in my 40s, I wrote in this voice, in this what I called the anonymous ventriloquized voice of the discipline. I wrote a bunch of essays that could have been written by anyone. There are 3 or 4 of them, and it doesn't seem obvious to me that I wrote them when I look back on them. They seem a bit inert, in fact. So I learned to write quite late on. I learned to write in my own voice quite late on. But one of the very first essays, in fact, the very first article I ever got published, was on the Mabo case.
Well, that's interesting, because my first article was also on the Marburg case.
Well, there you go. There you go. Yeah.
Anyway, go on. Please go on.
And I remember it fondly. It was a terrible struggle getting it published, in the sense that Melbourne University Law Review had accepted it, but the students, the editorial board, were unhappy with the form that I had written it in. And in fact, I remember having a bit of a confrontation at the annual dinner with the chief editor about the essay. And so it was written in a voice that seems, looking back on it, to be very much my own, a very sort of jejune effort, you know, very amateurish in lots of ways, but recognizably me. And you're right, to go back to the Mabo case itself, the Mabo case is insisting that native title follows some sort of domestication of the environment, a non-nomadic lifestyle, a pastoral lifestyle that's a form of sort of animal husbandry and permanence. So that's very true, you know, the Lockean idea of improving the land in some way, or mixing one's labor with the land, and that's absolutely right. And my gardening, my various gardening examples, try not to fall into that trap. But I didn't want to think of gardening in general as a sort of utopian alternative to trial. I wanted to, when I suggested gardening, I wanted people to be, well, actually, I didn't care what people thought. I expected some people to be a bit outraged, some people to think this was a very trivial way to go about one's business, that there were serious matters afoot, you know, this is not the time to talk about gardening and so on. But I wanted people to think more slowly, as it were, about international law. To use the pastoral to exemplify or enact some ideas I had about internationalism, to, you know, one of which was the idea of indirection, hesitancy, the idea that one simply doesn't really know the answers, that perhaps authoritativeness and solemnity are stylistic problems that go to the very heart of international law, that maybe it's a lack of playfulness and irony that is at least one of the reasons for all our problems, that our problems don't lie in enforcement or having the wrong sorts of norms or the wrong sorts of lawyers or insufficient expertise, or it's political, or it's about the great powers, but it might be something subtler, more stylistic, more about the way we talk. And I've been very much, again, to think about the various inspirations, provocations. I'd gone to a play in the West End when there were still plays in the West End called Consent, which was about a bunch of criminal lawyers who, you know, have affairs, get involved in sexual harassment issues, or get divorced from each other. And these lawyers in the play confront these problems, these interpersonal problems, using juridical language. And the juridical language is a failure. I mean, this is what the play is about. It's these lawyers coming home and treating their lovers as if they were litigants, and sort of litigating love through legal language. And you see the loss of identity, the sense that indignation, love, romance has been transmuted into some base metal through these efforts. And I wondered if there wasn't something in that for international law in general. So I not only do I argue for a different way of thinking about and speaking and writing international law, but I also enact it. Again, if that's not too sweepingly self-regarding, I try and enact that idea throughout the book. It's meant to be enjoyable. It's meant to provide solace at times. That's the general idea. I don't necessarily want to get onto the gardening just yet. I'm here. I am enacting my own ideas. I'm hesitating at the threshold of talking about what look like solutions at the end, but aren't.
Yeah. No. But I thought was intriguing about the gardening is that it builds on this notion that the way you write is a way of doing a kind of social sociality, or indeed there's a sort of history that emerges through writing, that it is in a sense through language that we encounter the world. And what you're enacting yourself is the creation of a world, if I'm not being too grandiose about it, through language. And so the different kind of practices of using language and the different sources that you draw on, the different instances, if you like, of invoking the garden is a way in which you create other spaces or enclaves. And I want to come back to enclaves, a different way in which we can find spaces to inhabit.
Ever since I was in my, you know, early 20s, late teens, I've, you know, tried to figure out. I can't say I did this in any systematic way. That would make me seem like an unusual teenager. But I was trying to figure out why certain pieces of literature or pieces of writing, certain poems, certain novels, certain literary essays, even literary criticism, which I actually read a lot of in my early 20s, why it worked or why it didn't work, why it moved me to action in some cases. And international law is a language, and it's intended to move us to action at the very least. So the question was, why or how did literature do this? And it turned out to me to have very little to do with the content of that literature. It didn't really matter what it was about. It didn't matter what was really going on. Sometimes, in fact, the same sentiment would either move me or not move me. Everything seemed to depend on the arrangement of words on the page. Sometimes it was a comma that made me laugh in some pieces of writing. Sometimes I was moved by a semicolon, if that doesn't sound utterly absurd. And so I thought maybe this is the same for international law, and maybe we haven't given enough attention to this. We've stated a lot over the years how important language is, but have we taken seriously that idea? You know, we've got used to the idea that it is a language, that it ought to be taken seriously as a language, but have we always taken it seriously as a language? Of course, there are people, Peter Goodrich, Desmond Manderson, characters like that, who've taken law very seriously as a language. But in international law, not so much. There are, of course, shining exceptions to this. But on the whole, we haven't thought about it. We haven't thought about it linguistically. We haven't thought about it as a mood, as in, you know, M-O-O-D. Karen Knopf once asked me after a talk what the word mood meant, M-U-D-E, but this was just my Scottish pronunciation of mood. So I wanted to get at the atmospherics and mood around international law. The problem of solemnity in particular always struck me as deep-seated, and it's something I write about in the essay. So I wanted to think about language in the book, its successes and its failings, and, you know, to think about what on earth a poetic international law might be and why we would want it. And I think in these times, to a certain extent, international law is an analytic and critical tool, but we also, especially when we teach and when we speak in public, we want to move people to action, and I think one of the problems with critical international law, or the image of it at least, is that it doesn't want to do that, is that the people think that mm-hmm. the movers and shakers lie in the pragmatic realm of classical international law, traditional international law, whatever it is, pragmatism, and that we as critics are doing something different that doesn't involve that. We eschew the idea of a solution. So I'm not offering solutions, of course, but as I say, I wanted to offer something a little more upbeat. I wanted to reoccupy the space that pragmatic international lawyers felt that they've occupied for decades. And I wanted to particularly reoccupy the space of longing and hope, which a certain sort of reformist international law has tended to think of as its own. I wanted to reclaim it, grab it back from that reformist sensibility, and bring it into the critical mainstream, if I can put it in that slightly contradictory mm-hmm, way. Mm-hmm. So that was a big part of the project.
Yeah, that's great. And one of the things I wanted to come back to in closing is the notion of the enclave that you referred to previously. And in a sense, in this approach of moving people to action through an atmosphere, through a mood, through language, one of the enclaves, if you like, in which that takes place is parts of the university, not all of the university, but you know, you and I and many of the people who we're reading and talking with, etc., are in universities, and the universities are under extraordinary threat at present with all kinds of forces across the world. And one of the things I sense in relation to kind of critical communities as a kind of enclave is that there's an extraordinary fragility to them, and they are also not necessarily things that endure. And perhaps, I mean, I could be wrong about this, and I'd be interested in your ideas that they are possibly fleeting moments, and maybe maybe it's the wrong thing to try to kind of monumentalize and sort of set them in stone, that perhaps the enclaves are fleeting. They come and go, and sometimes, like the references you make to the non-aligned movement or to Bandung, they're sort of past futures to be recovered, and that we shouldn't get too hung up on institutionalizing the enclave, if you like. And I think that can often be something that sort of critical thinkers want to do. They want to sort of establish their critical school of thought.
Yeah. I think there is a tendency in that direction in general. It's not peculiar to critical international law, which may be less guilty of that than most other traditions of internationalism, let's say. I agree with that. I often, so I would go to a meeting or a symposium of with a bunch of people I like, and we have this rich and entertaining discussion. And, you know, occasionally people will say we should have an edited book, or we should have a series of workshops. And that's fine, of course. But I sometimes think the edited book is the death of the idea. Somehow it becomes set in stone. It becomes a bit musty and fusty and so on. And that we could just live. You put it nicely, this idea of the fleeting fragility of the moment. I remember giving a talk in Liverpool once on international criminal law, very much along the lines of the conversation we've just had. And somebody, an NGO person at the back of the room, said to me, what do you propose that we do? And I said, I just did it. And she said, what do you mean? You didn't propose anything. I said, no, I just did it. I just did what you're supposed to do. I've just spent 45 minutes giving a talk, which is itself the enactment of what we could do. So it's only 45 minutes. It's fleeting, it's fragile, but it is actually the practice of international criminal law. Just as much as being involved in an endless interlocutory hearing in The Hague is the practice of international criminal law. So I was, you know, very dedicated to that idea. And I do think, as you say, that there are places in universities that remain enclaval, if you like, and that international law, I describe it as the last of the humanities. As you can imagine, that's caused outrage in some quarters, but I do think of it as the last of the humanities. If the humanities are being absorbed into a kind of technocratic space or a professionalized caste is taking over, then law will survive that. But that means that within law, there are only very few, or there will only be very few spaces where we can think non-instrumentally and imaginatively. And international law has always demanded that from us. It's precisely that sort of enterprise. It's maybe because of its unenforceability or its lack of lawlessness or whatever it is, but it's permitted us to think in these ways. And we just have to push that as hard as we can. And I see that all the time. I'm very optimistic about the discipline, international law, international criminal law, whatever it is. I see people around me doing just marvelous work. It's so literary, so creative, so imaginative. They're so entertaining, many of the people I admire and like and regard as friends in the field, that I think at least to that extent, it's healthy and it's playful and it's sometimes scurrilous. I mean, I talk about Diogenes a little bit in the book, and there is that spirit very much alive in internationalism and international law at the moment, and in particular, but not necessarily exclusively, in international criminal law. So I'm very keen to sort of exploit that idea and celebrate it. And I think, as I said at the beginning, I don't know if this was recorded, but I spoke about audiences and my imagined audiences, and I have many different audiences. I do want to reach out to, you know, beyond the typical audiences. I'm speaking to that audience. I'm speaking to my own audience, largely. I have to admit, I'm speaking to my friends. But as I said at the beginning, I'm also speaking to international lawyers in general, and I'm speaking to, you know, I'm speaking to my own daughters, one of whom came to one of these classes I teach at the LSC, and it occurred to me that I had to somehow offer a story for that generation who feel that the disaffection of their elders is producing a disaffection in them.
Oh, that's brilliant. Gary, this has been so wonderful, and I just feel really fortunate that I've had the opportunity to look at the parts of the book before it's published, and I really look forward to reading it. I think it's a wonderfully inspiring book, just because of the way it's been written, the range of sources, the atmospheres and moods that it invokes. And it's been fantastic to talk to you about it. So thank you so much for your time and joining me on Countersign.
Thank you very much. Great questions. I was very, very, felt very engaged throughout it. So thank you.
You have been listening to Countersign. Thank you for joining me. For more information, please visit countersignisapodcast.com.